Hello there, I'm Leslie Kerwin. Welcome to the download of Business Daily. Coming up, why on earth would China want a stronger currency?
China's actually developed to a certain stage that they should benefit more with a stronger Chinese yuan.
And can we trust Europe's politicians to solve the debt crisis?
In past European crises, there's usually been a muddle-through option. And that's what many Eurozone governments are hoping to get away with today.
That's all in Business Daily from the BBC. Figures from China show its economic growth slowed down over the first half of this year. In the first quarter, it was nearly 12%. In the second, it was around 10%. It is still one of the most dynamic economies in the world, and its success will anger critics in the US, who say that China benefits from keeping its currency artificially low, and that the end result of that is the loss of US manufacturing jobs. Of course, in June, Beijing effectively ended its currency peg between the value of the yuan and the dollar. The US Treasury admitted it was a significant move, and it stopped using the word manipulation about how China handles its currency. But the yuan has not risen in value significantly since then, and some voices in America are still raised loudly against China, including Clyde Prestowitz, who acts as an advisor to the Obama administration on China. He worked for previous US governments as a trade negotiator, and he's written a book called The Betrayal of American Prosperity. I asked him what he made of the value of the yuan.
I think that the Chinese currency is undervalued. In fact, China's policy is to maintain it undervalued. And this, of course, disadvantages U.S. exporters and distorts world markets. So my advice has been to try to rebalance that, ideally by negotiating some arrangement under which the Chinese would revalue their yuan. But if that's not possible, then, of course, Washington will have to think of other steps.
But China has already agreed to exercise more flexibility on the exchange rate, hasn't it?
Well, it's not clear specifically what China has undertaken to do. It has said that it will allow more flexibility. And in the wake of that, the yuan appreciated about 0.4% and then was stopped. So I think what's becoming clear is that China sees its needs as possibly having a bit more flexibility with the yuan, but not a lot.
So what are you saying an acceptable revaluation would be? You're talking about a 10% rise in the Chinese currency, more?
The Chinese currency is generally considered to be about 40% undervalued. And let me underline and emphasize that we keep saying China, but actually all of the Asian currencies kind of key off of China. So all of the Asian currencies are substantially undervalued. And so the point here is not just to get China to revalue, but really to get most of Asia to revalue. And I think what the U.S. needs is a pretty fast revaluation in the order of 20-25%.
But that's like asking turkeys to vote for Christmas, isn't it?
Not necessarily. In the mid-1980s, we had a similar problem with Japan. And in fact, the Plaza Agreement in 1985 did result in actually about a 40% revaluation of the Japanese yen. Remember that what we're talking about is not necessarily bad for China. Most economists think that it would be good for China. In fact, many Chinese economists think that.
Isn't it true that Americans are always trying to blame other people for the problems of America? The truth is that individual Americans just don't save enough, do you? I mean, don't you have to look to yourselves, really, to solve these imbalances?
Indeed, you're right that the U.S. must take measures to increase savings, although at this moment in the fragile global economy, I'm not sure that anybody else in the world wants the Americans to start saving heavily right now, since we're the only net buyer in the system. However, one of the reasons why we don't save as much as we should is because exactly of undervalued exchange rates in the rest of the world. The whole point of floating exchange rates is that when a country like the United States incurs huge trade deficits, the U.S. currency is supposed to devalue in order to make it more difficult for the Americans to import and thereby force them to save. And what's happening is because many Asian countries are counteracting the impact of the U.S. trade deficit, by intervening in currency markets to hold the dollar stronger than it should be, they are actually, in a way, preventing the Americans from saving more or encouraging them to continue to consume.
If the logical consequence of what you're looking for is that China has less money to spend, it's not going to be able to afford to buy so many U.S. government bonds, is it? I mean, that's what the U.S. is relying on.
No, that's not the logical consequence. Actually, a revaluation would give China more money to spend. They'd be able to buy more things with fewer yuan.
But Chinese businesses would be hit by it. So from that point of view, there will be less wealth.
Some Chinese businesses, it would cause a shift in structure. Export-oriented Chinese businesses would be hit by it, but domestically-oriented Chinese businesses would actually benefit. That's part of the reason. It's part of the reason why many Chinese economists, in fact, Chinese economists in the People's Bank of China, have been urging a movement in that direction.
Clyde Prestowitz. But are hopes for a big change in the value of the yuan realistic? Nicholas Kwan is the head of research for Standard Chartered Bank in East Asia. He told me that the US calls for a massive revaluation were not based on sound reason.
A lot of the arguments may not be substantiated, or at least not in a robust way. Say, for instance, her argument that the weak currency in China's side have led to the loss of jobs in America. I don't think too many Americans are interested in taking up the kind of jobs that the Chinese are doing to produce the product they sell to America.
What kind of thing do you mean?
What America buying from China is some of the basic necessities, food, clothing, shoes. These are low-tech products, labor-intensive industries, which honestly would not be able to support the kind of living standard in America. More likely, if the Chinese are not going to sell or couldn't sell to America because of a stronger currency, the snap will be picked up by other emerging markets like Mexico or other Asian producers. This kind of job is not going to flow back, and even if it flowed back to America, it wouldn't be economically feasible or make too much business sense.
So why would America claim that its jobs are being taken if it's not really true?
The reason why it's still being used, I think for some of the politicians, it's more convenient. For the general public in America, most of those probably don't pay too much attention to all those economic details. It sounds natural and sounds sensible. If I were to buy less from outside, I should be able to buy more from ourselves, which means that jobs will be created. The situation is that you probably end up buying from other people outside rather than from inside.
Would there be any advantages for China in allowing its currency to rise in value?
Definitely. China's actually developed to a certain stage that they should benefit more with a stronger Chinese yuan. What they're missing now is not foreign capital, but what they're missing now is the foreign resources, particularly natural resources and some high-tech technology. When you go out to shop to buy things, with a stronger currency is always for your benefit. So even without the push from America, I think China is well aware that it is for their long-term benefit to allow the currency to appreciate.
But there a political reason why they want to do it very slowly?
It is not just the Chinese way. I think it's more an Asian way. The lesson we learned from the previous crisis in Asia, and more likely from this current crisis in the West, that any sharp volatility and appreciation or depreciation of currency would not do good for the business as well as for the economy. It could create profit for some, but less likely for those who are in the long-term interests of the economy.
And yet there remain these voices in America which say very clearly, we want movement now, and that China is acting unfairly in the face of global pressure.
All this argument you can put in the context of less than economic argument. My guess is that from now till November, you will see just more and more pressure on the currency appreciation or the RMB appreciation to come.
Why November?
It's coming to the midterm election in America. So you need to have that away before you can see some scale down of the pressure.
Nicholas Kwan. You're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with Leslie Kerwin. The BBC's been looking in depth at the hard times caused by a wave of austerity measures which are engulfing Europe as governments try to get to grips with their budget deficits. You can find out more on the web at bbc.com/hardtimes. It's not just a problem about deficits, it's also about the shortcomings of the European single currency, the euro. Business Daily this week is on a mission to explain the origins of the eurozone crisis and its possible consequences. The BBC's economics editor, Stephanie Flanders, has been considering how the problems might be fixed.
Seasoned Europe watchers say there are only two ways out of this crisis for the eurozone. It could pull countries closer together, or it could break them apart. And that may be right, but in past European crises, there's usually been a muddle-through option. And that's what many eurozone governments are hoping to get away with today. Crucial to how it turns out will be Germany, where many are furious at the way things have gone. They don't like the idea of bailing out other countries at all. Bailing out Greece, a country that only qualified for the euro on dodgy budget numbers, well, that's about as bad as it gets. The German Chancellor has told them they have to support the massive new safety net for the eurozone because the future of the euro is the future of Europe and of Germany. But the real reason for Germans to support the single currency is that it has served them very well. As other countries have become less and less competitive, German companies have sailed ahead. Nearly all the growth that the German economy has had in the past 10 years has been through exports, most of them within Europe. German exports to Greece have risen 130% in the past 10 years. Greek exports to Germany have risen barely at all. German and French officials also tend not to mention that it was lending by their banks and investors that helped Greece, Spain and others to live so long beyond their means. The biggest economies in the eurozone are rallying around the support package because they think a default by a European government could be bad for everyone. But it's also because they know it would be particularly bad for the French and German banks, who are now sitting on a large amount of Greek and other sovereign debt. Supporters of a closer and deeper union say this is the way that European integration has always gone. The economic ties come first, and eventually the politics have to follow. But it's difficult to see much public appetite for deeper political integration within the eurozone, or massive budget transfers between states. Then again, most within the eurozone don't much like the breakup scenarios that some are painting, like having one euro for Northern Europe and one for the South. So yes, everyone really wants to find a way to muddle through. But if the eurozone is going to get through this without radical change, it's going to have to find a way to grow. Spain, Greece, Portugal and the rest all now face a long, hard slog, rebalancing their budgets and their economies. To make the numbers add up, they need a strong domestic recovery elsewhere. And right now, no one can promise them they'll get one.
Stephanie Flanders, the BBC's economics editor. Well, Stephanie studied it, Mick Jagger studied it, so did Arnold Schwarzenegger. Economics, that is. The last two never really made it as economists, sadly. It may be a mind-broadening discipline, but economics has been the target of a storm of criticism in the last couple of years. However, there's still general acceptance by governments that markets do work and that economies stick to a number of accepted laws. But mathematician David Orrell has rejected this belief system in his book Economyths. I asked him what kind of myths he was trying to debunk.
The way that we think about the economy is based on a number of kind of core ideas, and these include the ideas that the markets are rational, stable, and efficient. And I think that these are really, they're not really based on reality. They're actually myths about the economy. They're kind of a worldview rather than science.
Would you say that people still believe that markets are rational, stable, and efficient after what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years?
Certainly, you know, those ideas have been called into question by the recent financial crisis. But I think that our economic theories are lagging behind that perception, you know, from the general public.
Now, what made you look at this whole area? Because you're a mathematician, aren't you? You're not an economist. What drew you to it?
I actually got into it when I was writing an earlier book, looking at it from the position of an outsider. Mainstream economics is a mathematical model of human behavior. And from the point of view of mathematical models, it seemed that these assumptions that they were making were just very strange. I mean, for example, the idea that markets are stable, you know, from the outside, they don't appear stable at all.
But how much do those assumptions that you're talking about really matter when it comes to economics? After all, we do need it, don't we? We have to have planning of figures and measurements of the economy for governments to operate at all. So you can't disinvent mm-hmm. economics.
No, I think we can reinvent it, though. There is an alternative. Take, for example, the idea that markets are stable. This is something that was first proposed 150 years ago by the first neoclassical economists. And the reasons that they did it were really for mathematical convenience. I mean, at that time, they didn't have the mathematical tools for, you know, handling dynamic systems where you have a lot of change. Now we have new mathematical ideas coming from complexity theory, coming from network theory, which look at large interlocked networks. These are all areas of applied mathematics which have really sprung up in the last couple of decades. But economics is still lagging behind. These do have real implications, for example, in risk models. The risk models which are currently used by banks and financial institutions are based on an idea which came out of physics, which is that markets are inherently stable and they just kind of get perturbed randomly by disconnected events. And therefore, you can calculate the probability of a financial crash just by kind of looking back at the past and seeing how markets have fluctuated.
Now, I remember talking to other people in the last couple of years post the crisis where they were saying it's got to change. The risk modelling that you're talking about must change and will change because we know now that it just didn't work. Are you saying that actually it hasn't changed?
It's sort of happening in a bit of a void in a way, you know, because the sort of the ideology about stable markets and so on, the efficient market hypothesis, because that's sort of hanging around, I think that's impeding progress. Having said that, I don't think the answer is all in mathematics. I mean, a lot of this just comes down to a little bit of, you know, common sense. Part of the thing is that we put too much trust in mathematical models. So if it looks like there's a bubble, then maybe there is a bubble.
I have to say that I can imagine how a lot of economists are going to respond to what you're saying. They'll say it's easy for you to carp from the sidelines. You don't have to do the job. You're not a trained economist. You're a mathematician. You're seeing it from a mathematician's point of view.
People have been carping from the sidelines for about the last 100, 150 years, actually. You know, I think a more interesting question than that, actually, is why have these ideas persisted for such a long time when they are so strange?
And why have they?
Really, the reason that neoclassical economists 150 years ago decided to assume rational behavior and equilibrium for the markets is because mathematically it is easier to predict the behavior of a rational person than it is to predict the behavior of an irrational person. The other reason for the persistence of these theories, and probably the most basic one, just comes down to power. The main kind of lesson, I guess, of mainstream economics is that free markets correctly allocate resources. And this is obviously a very good story for the very small percentage of people who are really benefiting from that system at the moment.
David Orrell. Well, is he right? Is economics based on a series of myths? You can email us at world.business@bbc.co.uk.